Well, hey friends, welcome to the Everyday Mealmanship Podcast. Thanks for being here. I'm Ty Evans. In this episode, this is probably one of my rambling episodes, but you know, the last rambling episode I got, you guys sure left a lot of good comments, so apparently you like them. I'm going to talk to you about our clinic in Florida, talk to you about our clinic in South Carolina, and then I'm also going to talk to you about Grandma. And a lot of you know about Grandma. If you don't, listen to the end, and you get to learn about Grandma. She's a very special person. But thanks for listening to this, you guys. I got to give a huge shout out to our sponsors that make this episode and these podcasts free for you to listen to. Western Meal Magazine, been supporting me for years. I write an article for them every month, so you got to check them out. Also, Mules and More Magazine. My buddy Corey over there does a great job at editing and puts together a fantastic product. Also, big shout out to Diamond W Enterprises. Hey, it's that time of year to get your mares bred and be looking forward to next year's mule foals. And if you're looking for a really good jack, you got to look up Diamond W Enterprises. Find them on Facebook. My buddy Kevin Wright over there, he's got a dang good jack. Check him out. Colt Saddlery, always treating us good, building some dang good gear. My buddy Ben Lewis at Roman Home Tents. If you're like me, like to hunt, pack, fish, get out there and enjoy the great outdoors, you got to do it in a Roman Home Tent. Check them out. Go to RomanHomeTents.com. Hey guys, thank you so much, and here we go. Holy cow, the last about 10 days has been just kind of a whirlwind. Kind of went by crazy fast. And I got all kinds of stuff I want to talk to you about. This might be one of those rambling episodes, so sorry about that. But finished up our clinic in Florida. We had a private clinic down there. If you listened to the last episode, I recorded that while I was down there in Pinellas Park, Florida. Got hired to do a private clinic. Those are really fun, those private deals. You know, it's just one person hires me to come out there with their group of people that they want, you know, whoever they invite. You know, they're limited to four people. But it's really neat because I show up and, hey, what do you want to work on? And that's what we get to do. Great bunch of people out there. So the individual that set this clinic up and put everything together, her name is Nancy, and she's got a mule named Yodel. I thought that was a pretty cool mule name, Yodel. Nancy basically wanted some help getting things going. She had bought this mule. I don't remember when she told me. And over a period of time, basically, the relationship between people and mule was just kind of collapsing, and she wanted some help with it. She wanted to, take that extreme ownership, right, and step up and get some help and see what she needs to do to be better. The mule particularly was her son Casey's, and Casey, he's new to equine. I mean, he's played around with horses and mules and stuff, you know, along with his mom. But this was his mule, so the focus was definitely on him learning some skills to get along with Yodel. And, you know, I really enjoy working with people that are brand new to this stuff because they don't come with any habits. They don't come with any, even any muscle memory, right, of how to do certain exercises or rein positions or leg and seat positions, none of that. They're brand new. And Casey was, I mean, he really impressed me because I explained to him, well, one particular move that I want to mention, you know, on the ground, we are going through our groundwork checklist, working our way up the list, going through the moves. He's doing good. And we get to a move. And those of you that have been to a clinic, you know what I'm talking about here. But those of you that are, you know, you don't know, it's okay. Don't worry about it. You can see videos on the library. But the move is roll the hinds, roll the front on the ground. Okay. This is a groundwork move. So this involves your feet on the ground. You got a lead rope. You got a flag. It requires you to change hands with your leader, open your flag. And the first part of it is yielding the hindquarters away from you. The second part of it is yielding the front end away from you. So you drift, picture drifting the hindquarters to the mule's right and bringing the front quarters to the mule's left. It can seem challenging on the start. It can seem pretty challenging when you first begin this. But not for Casey. He watched me do it. I explained it, and I tried to be as thorough as I could, keep it as simple as I could. That's something I've been really trying to do. I mean, in my classes for sure, but also with my mules, is just keep it simple. Like, we don't have to make it so complicated. I don't know why we have to make things so complicated. You know, especially in the equine world, like all of us teachers, we have to like name things different. It's the same stinking move. You know, like I say, roll the hinds. That also could be turn on the forehand, yield the hinds, untrack the hinds, disengage the hinds. I don't know. That's just a little squirrel thought for you. How can we have to name things different? So weird, right? But anyways, try to keep it simple for him. And because of that, Casey was able to nail it. Just nailed it right from the beginning. So smooth, so good. I was very impressed. While I was there, Ron, the owner of the barn, you know, he's very experienced. He's been around horses and mules quite a lot. I was really impressed with his genuine interest in being better. You know, I appreciate that more and more these days. I mean, more and more, you know, when I meet people, it can be interesting because they might come with their preconceived notions of things or how to do things. And so it's really impressive to me when somebody shows up and they are absolutely interested in learning and being better. One of the first things that I had Ron do was catch this mule. Now, this mule Yodel basically has stranger danger. Okay, so, you know, I walk in the pen with it, and if I'm not being really aware of this mule's expressions and its body language, what it's telling me, it could be really easy to just kind of blow this mule up, you know, kind of really set it off. And Ron was kind of having that issue happening, and all the other strangers around, anybody that besides basically Nancy and Casey and their trainer Kim, who was also part of this clinic. If it wasn't one of those three, the mule had problems. And basically what I explained to them was, you know, we call it a case of the familiars. You know, and this happens all the time. People think, well, my mule's great to catch. Yeah, for you. I want my mule good to catch for anybody. If my mule got loose and is, you know, they're trotting down the road and a police officer stops by, maybe the police officer has no clue how to catch a mule or my horse or whatever. They have no idea. They don't know which end to put the halter on, maybe. That's fine. I want my mule or my horse good enough that anybody could catch them. That's what I'm working for. I don't want them just to be familiar. And that happens a lot. You know, I know a lot of you listening, it's just you living at home. Maybe you're by yourself. It's just you working with your mule. It's just you doing the chores. It's just you saddling up. It's just you, you know, handling this animal completely. And I get that. That's your situation. That's just reality. That's just life. But what I'm saying is there's things that you can do to get it to where anybody can catch this animal. And one thing I worked with Ron particularly was positioning to get the mule to catch them, and also focusing on getting the mule ready to catch, not the actual catching. It's a mindset difference when you do that. When you think about getting them ready to catch, that's helping them be prepared. That's helping them get in the right position, get in the right frame of mind to allow you to catch them. If you can do that, then putting the halter on is no big deal. But a lot of times we go in there, and definitely the focus is you know, let's just catch them, corner them, and then maybe they turn away. This mule is wanting to turn away quite a bit, which is normal for an animal that's scared. That's flight. Let's just flee the scene, get away from this pressure, which is us, the person trying to catch the animal, right? So turning away. Well, the next thing that a lot of people want to do is just drive the animal. Like, okay, well, it's turned its butt to me. I'm just going to wail on it, you know, with a lead rope. And I'm not going to argue that that's not effective, because I've done that a lot of times and it is effective. I can't catch the tail. And so a lot of times if one will face up to me, not face up to me and just kind of turn their butt to me, then yeah, you can just drive the tail away from me. And as soon as they yield the hip away from you, you release. But there's a difference in setting them up for position or just focusing on making it hard not to be caught, you know. And the approach, you know, paying attention to the expression, you know, as we are catching our animals, we should be trying to make a bid for connection, trying to communicate with them. And I'm not trying to get fluffy on y'all. What I'm saying though is this communication goes both ways. I'm not just talking at my mule. I'm talking with my mule. And I'm reading those expressions. I want them to know I care. I want them to know that, hey, I have enough awareness here that I can see kind of how you feel. And maybe I'm coming in a little too hot. Okay, I better cool off. Maybe take a minute to pause. You know, I think a lot of us take for granted the domestication of these animals. I think so many of us work animals that are so stinking gentle that we might forget how we should be working and how we should be positioning for an animal that's really uncomfortable. Like, and I just see it in my clinics. Very few people really these days are getting a chance to work something that is truly touchy, really wild, really fearful. I'm seeing it less and less, which is good for you. I mean, I'm glad you guys don't have to deal with the wild the wild crazies. The animals are, you know, the horses and the mules are so sensitive that they'll run through a fence. You know, those are getting more rare. I do still see them now and again, but it's rare. Usually I'm dealing, like with this particular mule, Yodel, an animal that has some learned avoidance. That's different than wild. However, the same principles apply. They get that way. They learn to avoid because basically it's a one-way communication. The human's talking at the mule. And the mule learns to survive by avoiding you. They learn to get along by ignoring you. They get along by blocking you out. And they also learn to get along by learning that you are perhaps a discounted human. What I mean by that is if you don't have that mule leader-esque about you, if you don't have that draw of confidence, that draw of protection, I'm not saying you're a mule boss. I'm saying you're a mule leader. If you don't have that draw and that confidence and that connection that I'm trying to speak of here, the mule will discount you. They'll be like, "Now, you know, you're just the bozo that feeds me." And as long as you have your treats in your bucket and your, you know, your feet or whatever, they'll be there. But as soon as the treats in the bucket were, you know, run out, now you're just back to playing nobody. And that can be a pain. And I think some of that happened with Yodel too a little bit. So it was fun to work with them and help them learn position. You know, something that we did with their trainer, Kim, was work on changing eyes. So basically, Yodel was just loose in the pen. And this is just a little, I don't know, maybe it was a, I'm not sure how big these stalls were. I'm guessing like a 14 by 14. Maybe it was smaller. I don't know. I'm just guessing, but doesn't matter. So I asked Kim, I said, "Hey, why don't you step around Yodel's hip? And I want to see the mule change eyes." What was happening is Kim would walk around behind the animal here, Yodel, and Yodel would really have to fling her whole body around and got really bothered. So she wanted to quickly put Kim in the other eye. As you walk behind these animals, you realize there's a blind spot there. And some of them have a mental disconnect if you're walking, say, from left to right of the mule. And you'll see this when mules are tied up to the trailer all the time. Maybe they're tied up. You're on the left side. You go to walk around to the right side, and the mule has to move their entire hip over to accommodate that. Instead of just standing, you know, teed off to the trailer, you know, facing the trailer, they have to be on one side or the other. And a lot of them get pretty bothered about this. So we work on changing eyes. This is an exercise that we focus on. And I had her do this. And in the beginning, Yodel was having a really hard time, you know, making that change from left eye to right eye or vice versa. But eventually, after sticking to it for a little while, the mule came through. And we were talking about sticking to it, hanging in there. You know, the first day I was there for this clinic, this private clinic, basically four people, one mule, right? The first day I'm there, we spent 2 hours just getting Yodel ready to catch and focusing on getting the mule prepared, but also preparing ourselves to catch the mule. We worked on everything from how you hold the halter when you step in there, how you have your lead rope organized. It made a difference. Ron went to catch the mule and he had the halter in one hand, lead rope in the other hand. And as he's going to put the halter, you know, around the neck and get the nose in there, the way he's holding the lead rope was really bothering the mule. And I said, why don't you just put that lead rope in the crook of your arm and see how that might make a change. See, in the beginning, we got to make the changes for the animal. You've heard me speak of this, and if you've been to my clinics, you've heard me quote this, but, you know, a famous thing in, you know, that Ray Hunt would speak of in his clinics, and if you read his book, Think Harmony with Horses, he would talk about first going with the horse, then the horse going with you, and then you go together. Well, in the beginning, more of us need to be accommodating and go with the animal. There's a certain time there toward the beginning of all this work where you do need to accommodate the animal. Now, eventually, they need to come with us. Eventually, Ron should be able to walk up and have his halter or whatever in a mess, and he should be okay. But in the beginning, he has to accommodate this mule. We gotta build a relationship. If you can work on building that relationship before you get to working on a whole bunch of maneuvers and a whole bunch of turns and stops and backs and crossing creeks and making a pack mule, making a riding mule, whatever you're into, roping off them, doesn't matter. If you can build a little bit of a relationship in the beginning, the maneuvers sure come along pretty darn easy. I found it to be so much easier to get things going. Now, when I'm talking about a relationship, I'm talking about a clear communication line. I'm not talking about, oh, well, just because I pet them, they love me, or just because I give them a treat, they love me. I'm talking about a mule and a person learning each other's boundaries, learning how to communicate, and building from there. So this is not fluffy, like, you know, my mule loves me, unconditional. That's not it. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about when I approach the mule, if I see that the mule is bothered, I might hit the pause button. When that mule realizes that I'm aware and that I am paying attention to how they feel in this manner, they draw a connection to me. They're like, okay, this guy's paying attention. That's what I'm talking about. And if I can install this when I am just very first, you know, catching the mule, getting them ready to catch, that kind of stuff, it will go a long way. It'll go a really long way. So we worked on this a bunch the first day. Second day, it was much easier. Third day, piece of cake. Typical third day stuff. You guys have heard me hammering on y'all the last couple years about 3 days in a row. 3 days in a row is a game changer. So I shared this with Casey at the Florida clinic because they board this mule at a stable and he signs up for riding lessons with Kim, the trainer, 3 days a week. And I can't remember exactly the days. I believe he comes on Mondays and Tuesdays and doesn't come Wednesday and comes back Thursday. And he's asking if this is okay. I'm like, well, you know what? That's really great that you can come out and at least do 2 days in a row and then a bonus day at the end. But I encouraged him, hey, well, can you come out here on Wednesdays? And he's like, well, yeah. I'm like, well, come out. You don't have to have the trainer, you know, like babysit you. You can come out and do your own thing. So why don't you work with the trainer Monday and Tuesday? Wednesday, you keep working, do your own thing. You need time to experiment. And then Thursday, you can have a bonus day, work on obstacles or work on something different. And he said that sounded pretty good. And he was a little worried about working on his own without the trainer there, or without me there, or somebody else there. And I said, hey, man, you know, you need the time to practice and to experiment and to do your own thing without having anybody tell you what to do. You just play around and communicate with the mule. Because the problem, it's not a problem, I'm just saying it's an obstacle. When if you take a lesson, and it could be from me, it could be from anybody, but you take a lesson, so you're there, the mule's there, and the trainer's there. All right. Now, a lot of people really need this. This is a good thing, but you also need time on your own, because when the three of you are together, there is a little different communication between you and the animal than when it's just you and the animal, just you and your mule, just you and your horse. It's different. So you need time on your own. And this goes for all of you. I mean, everybody listening, like, there's a lot of people that don't want to ride by themselves. I get it. I totally get it. I mean, you know, you do this as a social event. You do this to visit with your spouse, your husband, your wife, you know, your kids, your friends, whatever. This is a social event for a huge majority of people. And that's fine. And even if you meet up for a lesson and you're there and your friends are there, they have their own animals. Everybody has their own animals. That's still not what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is we need to have time, just us and the animal, to work through stuff and experiment, play around, and build that relationship and build the skills without having anybody looking at you, without having anybody telling you what to do or you feeling judged even. You just see, that's the other part of it is ride when you know nobody's watching you. How does that feel? You know, when nobody else is there at the barn, nobody else is there at the arena, nobody's on the trail, whatever it is, your backyard, doesn't matter, but just you and the animal. I would encourage more of you to have experiences like that, although it might not sound safe. I mean, obviously, use common sense, be safe. I'm not endorsing you to be unsafe. But I'm telling you that you need that time where there's no hidden agenda, when there's nobody watching. And if you can keep your integrity, and if you can stay pure to the things that we're teaching and pure to what you know to be the right thing to do when nobody else is watching, that's pretty cool. That's pretty darn cool. Because a lot of people, when nobody's watching, we all have that temptation, you know. I mean, think of even me, myself, okay? I definitely feel a pressure to be an example to everybody. So if you come on a trail ride with me, we're not even at a clinic. We're just going to go trail ride. We're going to go hunt. We're going to go play in the rocks. Doesn't matter. You're going to come hang out with me. I will admit, there is a pressure that I feel to be an example to you. I should do my work on the ground, check it off, to be an example to you. I have to go through the list of things that I work on every time I ride during that ride to be an example to you. The real test of integrity, the real test of faith, is when nobody's watching me and I still go through my groundwork checklist. I still do my riding checklist. I still have integrity to do all the things I need to do. I still give my mule soak time. I still give him a chance to think and work things out. That is integrity. And I was telling Casey this at the Florida clinic, that you need that day on your own with nobody else there to practice your integrity. You ever thought about having to practice integrity? There you go. Practice having faith in the process. You got to go do it. You got to work through it. that was a pretty fun conversation. Something else there at the Florida clinic that came up a lot was mule myths. Oh my gosh, poor Nancy. She has heard so many mule myths. You have to have a mule saddle. You have to have this type of bit, this double twisted wire, whatever. You have to have this Mylar, whatever. You have to have this. Mules can't do that. Mules can't do this. All kinds of myths. And when she would bring one up, my first question was why? Why does a mule have to have this mule saddle? Well, we started talking about saddle fit. Okay, so as we kind of dove into it, I'm not going to dive into it on this podcast, but we kind of dove into the saddle fit. I said, okay, so the real principle is not that a mule has to have a, quote, mule saddle. It's that they need a saddle that fits. Does that sound correct? She says, yeah. Like, there you go. When it comes to all these bits and gimmicks and gadgets and gizmos, you know, who is to say what's right and wrong? Who's to say you can only have this bit or only have that bit? There's definitely a process I follow. And if you're this far into our podcast, you've heard me talk about making bridle mules for a long time. I've been talking about making bridle mules for years and years and years. And there's most definitely a process, right? I start them in a snaffle. I ride them in a snaffle for about 3 years. I get everything taught in the snaffle bit. There's nothing new learned after the snaffle bit. There's only refinement. I'm talking about maneuvers. I move into the hackamore for about a year to work on refinement. I move into the two rein for a year to introduce the bridle bit and to continue working on refinement. All the way till I graduate to being straight up in a bridle bit, which is maybe a spade, maybe a half breed. There's different types of bridle bits. But the point is, that is the process that I go through. Is that the only way? No. No, no, there's not. That's not the only way. There's all kinds of other things you can do. And it's just fine. I have found what I just shared with you to be the best route to getting the results that I want. Did you hear how I said that? That's the best route for getting the results that I, Ty Evans, wants. I have not found a better way to get to what I'm trying to achieve. The true lightness, the true self-carriage, that feel, you know, that's how I achieve it. Now there's other standards of riding, and you can put whatever you want on your animal. But you can't come and tell me you want your animal to be so light and so soft and have the self-carriage and collection and use all these fluffy words. And then you put some gadget that's going to pinch their nose and squish their jaw and crush their brain and gag them at the same time. That doesn't go together, right? So what result do you want? You know, if you say, well, I just want to poke down the trail. Okay, well, how do you want to poke down the trail? What does that mean to you? Well, I just want to be able to turn left, right, stop, back. Okay, all right, well, stay in the snaffle bit forever. That's pretty much all you need. You don't need to advance out of it. You don't need to move out of it. But you dang sure don't have to have some other bit that's going to inflict pain and get all your movements off of pain infliction. You don't have to have that. So who's to tell you that you have to have that? So there's a lot of a mule myths, I call them, that poor Nancy had to work through. You know, all kinds of stuff. A whole bunch of other things, you know, and we've done podcast episodes on mule myths, so I don't need to go into all of them here. But the point was, that was a huge part of the conversation as we were working with them. You know, of course, the big one, they're totally different than horses. You can't work them the same as horses. And again, my question is, why? Whenever somebody says something, and believe me, if you come to my clinic, you can ask me why anytime. But somebody says, oh, you can't work them the same as horses. Why not? I love what Tom Dorrance had to say. He said, you have to treat the mule the way you should treat the horse. This is key. So if I treat every horse the way I treat my mule, I'm good to go. I am good to go. I have no issues, no problems. And so far, the thousands of horses and the thousands of mules, you know, that have been to the classes and that I've been able to work with, hey, they're good to go. No problems. So when people come up with these things, if you don't understand it, if it sounds a little funky, then just ask why. Let's hear a good explanation. If the explanation seems common sense, and by the way, is simple. This stuff doesn't have to be hard. This stuff doesn't have to be hard, you guys. Keep it simple. If it's simple and if it makes sense, we're probably on the right track. And if it keeps the mule at the forefront of care, if it keeps the mule on the high end of care and puts them first, you're probably good to go. So most of the private clinic there in Florida kind of went like that, talking about the myths, working through movements, did a lot of groundwork, went through the whole groundwork checklist and answered a lot of questions. They all came each day with a lot of questions. And I enjoyed sitting there on that. They had a beautiful porch there. And, you know, the weather was great. I enjoyed answering their questions and talking mules and horses. That was a great time. After 3 days of that, or I should give you a couple more details. Like I said, this is probably a rambling episode for sure. But, you know, I went out to Indian Rocks Beach one night, and that was pretty fun. Watched the sun go down. I enjoyed that. Got some seafood. And I learned something about seafood. I mean, I love shrimp. I always have loved shrimp. But and I've ate crab a few times. In fact, I went crabbing at a clinic with my good buddy Mike Mache out in Dunedin, California. Shout out to my buddy Mike. But and we had crab there, but he helped me crack it all. You know, and he kind of took care of me. So I got seafood though when I was in Florida. And they brought me out crab and the cracker, you know, and I'm like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And, you know, they said, oh, well, just, you know, you ever done this before? I'm like, no, treat me like a beginner. I want to be a beginner here. I don't want the halfway version here. Just tell me how to do this. And they said, well, we'll bring you this. And then we're also going to bring you some scissors. You can just kind of cut it open, cut the claws open, whatever. So, they said beginners usually do this. I said, hey, I'm fine. I just want to eat the meat inside of it. Okay. And anyways, even using the scissors and using the crab cracker, it was still quite a bit of work for that little teeny morsel of meat in there. But that meat was pretty darn good. And I was thinking to myself as I was eating that, I was like, I wonder if people feel this way when they start riding with me in my clinics, that, you know, there's a lot of work involved on the beginning end of things, and you only get a little morsel of progress at a time. It feels like it's not like you get this huge, very few people come to a clinic and get a huge, big reward, like meaning a massive change. It's usually you just come get a little morsel of knowledge. Your mule or your horse teaches you what you need to learn at that time. And it's just, but what you do learn is pretty dang good. That little morsel of meat that you get at a clinic is worth it, usually. At least I think so. And as I'm eating this crab, I'm thinking the same thing, like, this is a lot of work. It's good that this meat tastes so good. So even though it was a little morsel, and if you're judging the crab off of the, you know, how much you get, the quantity, if you're judging that crab eating experience off the quantity, it's not worth it. But if you judge it off the quality of the meat, now we're talking. And I was just thinking to myself as I was sitting there all alone, I'm like, I wonder if people feel this way when they come to clinic sometimes. Maybe they do. But hopefully, whatever little morsels you get at a clinic, whatever your mule or your horse has to teach you at that clinic at that time, I really hope that it is worth it for you. So after I finished up the clinic on Friday night, I went to the airport in Tampa. And my flight kept getting pushed back little by little. It was delayed just a few minutes. And then we'd get an update and it would show a little longer delay. Another update until now my flight is over an hour delayed. And I didn't have a very long layover in Atlanta. So here's a huge word of advice. If you know you have a layover in Atlanta for your connecting flight, don't book a layover less than 2 hours in Atlanta. Like no way, no way. I've had too many close calls with the airport in Atlanta. That was where my connection was. And so I'm sitting there in Tampa, Florida, and seeing this delay. I'm like, oh man. And I'm starting to wonder, well, what happens to your bag, like your checked bag, if you don't make the flight, or like if you miss a flight, or you know, whatever. Because I checked most of my stuff in a big suitcase. So all I have is my boots, you know, my jeans, a t-shirt and a hoodie, my cowboy hat, and like my water bottle in my backpack, and like my computer. Like that's all I have in my backpack. All my gear, all my extra clothes, everything is on this check bag. So I'm thinking, dang it. If that gets lost, even if it's just a couple of days, that's all my stuff. And I got another clinic I'm headed to in South Carolina, right? And so anyways, well, it's not in my control, right? We've talked about this before on the podcast. Control the controllables. All I can control right now is my attitude and how I react to this delayed flight. And unfortunately, there were quite a few people that were going to miss their connections. And a bunch of them, you know, since they were going to Atlanta, was a bunch of international connections that they were going to miss, which is a bigger deal. I'm just going to Charlotte. So I'm going from Tampa to Atlanta to Charlotte. So, I mean, I'm going to get there. There's all kinds of flights going to Charlotte. So like, I'm not worried about getting to the clinic, but these other people are really worried about getting to their international connections. And there's some mad people, and there's some people that were very disrespectful to, you know, the flight agents or whatever you call them, you know, at the desk there. And there's quite a bit of tension in the air, you know. Well, what can I do? I can't control the plane. Like that's out of my control. I can't, at this point, I've checked my bag. I can't control where my bag is going to end up, right? I can control my attitude though. So I know I'm going to miss my connection. I'm like, there's no way I'm making it. And I'm a positive guy. You guys all know I'm really positive. Like usually everything works out for me. That's just my attitude. It's going to work out. And so I'm trying to be positive, but then like, realistically, I'm thinking, yeah, right. Tight. You aren't making this connection. So I get on the plane, you know, from Tampa to Atlanta, whatever. Okay. I'm not worried about it. As we land in Atlanta, I'm just waiting any second to get service on my phone, you know, to check the status of the next flight. By the time we actually landed in, you know, I would have technically already missed my flight. Okay. So I'm like, I missed it for sure. As soon as my phone opened up, it shows that Delta automatically rebooked me for the morning to go to Charlotte. All right, cool. So I text Bob Camberg, Bob and Alicia. They're the hosts of our clinic in South Carolina. And Bob was planning to pick me up at Charlotte. I text Bob and say, hey, Bob, I missed my flight. I'm not going to make it. They rebooked me for the morning. So I guess I'll see you in the morning. Thanks, man. And he said, no problem. See you in the morning. So I get off the plane and I'm kind of walking casually down the hallway there, down the terminal, trying to figure out. I'm like, okay, well, I wonder, so if I'm not going to board until the next morning, like 7:30 in the morning, and this is like 8:50, 9 o'clock at night, like, can I go get my bag and like go get a hotel room, or does my bag have to stay out? And I guess I'll just go with my backpack, you know, whatever. Or do I just sit here in the terminal and wait, you know, till the morning? I'm thinking about that, just walking casually, like taking my dear sweet time. And my phone vibrates. I open it up and I got a notification from Delta. Says, you know, your flight boarding ends in 10 minutes. Like, I'm like, oh crap. And I look at it and it had the apparently the flight I was supposed to catch, my connection I was supposed to catch, it was delayed also. It was delayed 45 minutes. And so they were boarding right when I got off the plane. They're boarding and they're like 10 minutes to till boarding ends. So I'm like, oh crap, I'm in terminal A. I got to get to terminal D. So I just am so grateful that I exercise a lot because I felt pretty good, but I had to book it. I ran for all I could. I get down to the train, the shuttle train, whatever you call that thing, train shuttle. Jump on, I'm like, and I'm just watching that time tick, and we're going, you know, A, and it's going B, you know, we're moving along there, C, and at C, the doors are about to shut. You know, they're warning, stand back, the doors are about to shut. And you guys, the shuttle doors in Atlanta, just so you know, if you ever go, they're not like the elevator. You don't stick your arm in there and think they're going to stop and open up for you. It doesn't work like that. It just goes and stops. So the doors are closing and this lady like throws her purse, like her bag. I think it was her purse. I don't know, her bag, something. She like swings it into the doors thinking that the doors will sense that there's an object and stop and reopen. And, but it doesn't work like that. So this guy on the inside where I'm at in the shuttle, inside of the train shuttle, he sticks his arm in and he's pushing the bag back out so she can get her bag because it's shutting. So he's shoving, and as he shoves it through, he gets the bag through. So the lady has her bag. So she didn't make the shuttle. But when he did that, his arm gets stuck in the shuttle door and people start screaming right off. And this is all happening like in, what I'm telling you is happening like in 3 to 5 seconds. It's fast. I'm on the other side of the shuttle, so it's too far for me to help him out, unless it's stuck, I guess. But so his arm is open through the doors, like stuck in the doors that are barely open, and the shuttle starts to move. Like he's going to get his arm tore off on the walls of the tunnel. Like this is going to be bad. And so luckily, a couple of guys right behind him, they grab onto him and they're jerking his shoulder out of socket. It's probably trying to pull him back in. And luckily they squeeze him back in. Everybody's like, holy crap, are you all right? Like it kind of made a few people distraught. And everybody's like, dude, you're crazy, man. Like, whoa. And for like a split second, I'm just thinking this guy's going to get his arm tore off and I'm not going to make my flight. I'm admitting my selfish thought. I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be so bad. But luckily, he was rescued. The guys behind him, they helped him out. They rescued him, pulled him out of there. The next stop, just moments later, was Terminal D. So I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. And these guys are all still talking about this experience they just had, right? So I kind of push through him and I just run for all I can down the terminal. And I get there to my gate and there's just two people left to board. Like it's 1-2 me. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I made it. Like I made my flight and I was good to go. So I got on my flight and I'm thinking, oh man, what about my bag? There's no way my bag will have made it. So by the time I get off the plane by the time I get on my next gate, I mean, it has probably been, it's probably been 15 minutes is all because I was just walking down the hall, you know, probably for about 5 minutes before I felt my phone buzz. And then I had 10 minutes to get to the gate. So it's probably only been 15 minutes. There's no way my bag made it. And it didn't. I'm watching the bag status and it said it got off the plane, but it never got on the next one. So I'm like, oh, dang it. Well, now what happens? I'm going to make it to Charlotte, you know, but, my bag's not. What happens now? But again, it's out of my control. I can't control it. Control the controllables, just like on your mule. So I text Bob back. This is just moments later, right? I said, Bob, never mind. I freaking ran, man. I made my flight. It was delayed, so I'm good to go. I'm headed your way, man. And he's like, all right, cool. All right. Well, and I said, I don't think my bag is going to make it though. So I don't know what to do about that. And, well, we'll figure it out when we get there. So I get on the plane. I'm hot and sweaty. I just ran. I just did some running, had some stress on the train. I sit down next to this guy. And I say, sorry, man, I hope I don't stink too bad. I know I'm sweating. I just ran hard. He's like, heck yeah, well, good for you. Good for you. It's good for you to run. He made that type of a comment. I'm like, hey, this guy's cool. And as we sat down, got settled in, started visiting with him. And it turns out he is a president of a college in North Carolina. And I thought, hey, that's pretty dang neat. That's a position of leadership. And I kind of wanted to talk to him about it a little bit more. And so, you know, I just kind of started picking his brain a little bit. Like, so what's that like to be in that leadership position? And we just started talking and he started asking me about what I do. And we started talking about leadership principles. And he said, you know, actually before I became this president, I was a head football coach for a college. And I'm like, sweet, this is even better. We got a head football coach. He's got some leadership skills. And we just started swapping leadership skills, paralleling them between mules and football and you know, being a leader the president of a college, dealing with people, dealing with animals. We just started making parallels. And it was amazing, the parallels. But my favorite moment of our chat. We talked the entire flight from Atlanta to Charlotte, which was about an hour and 15 minutes, hour and a half or something like that. We talked the whole time. It's been my favorite plane conversation I've ever had. And it makes me want to have more plane conversations because usually the folks don't want to talk to me. I try to talk to just about everybody usually, but sometimes they just don't want to talk. I get it. And he said, you know, And he shared one of the cliche quotes, right? Nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. And I said, you know, that's the same exact thing with the mules. Like, they don't care who you are. The mule doesn't care how much money you make. They don't care about your job. They don't care about how much you paid for them. They don't care about anything except for how much you care. And care is felt through feel. And we were talking about that when he was about his coaching experiences. You know, the players, he said, the players could see right through you. They could see if you were just being, you know, just a generic football coach, just going through the plays, whatever, the X's and the O's, you know, type of thing. And versus if they knew you really cared about them as players. And man, the parallels with the mulemanship was just so thick. A quote that he said that I wrote down, he said, it's not leadership is not about the X's and the O's. It's about the Jimmies and the Joes. I was like, man, that's so good. That's so good. It's the same thing with mules. Like, you come to a clinic and sure, we talk about the groundwork checklist and the riding checklist and we go through maneuvers and we share principles. And all these things are very important, but the main thing to take away is treat them as individuals. They are individual animals. They are individual creatures. Work with them. They are unique. They are unique. It's so fun. It's the same thing with our mules as it is with you know, Coach Cruikshank talking about his athletes and about the people that he leads it. You know, in his presidency. It was really neat. It was a fantastic conversation, you know, just so much good. And, you know, I encourage, if you're out there, you never know who you're going to sit next to on a plane. Maybe strike up a conversation and maybe a mule trainer and a football coach can have a chat. You never know. It was pretty special to me. So made it to Charlotte, got off the plane, told Bob I landed, and I said goodbye to Coach Cruikshank. I appreciated his chat a lot. And Bob says he's just about there. I said, well, I got to figure out where my bag is. And the bag updated and it had been expedited. Luckily, there was a flight out from Atlanta right after mine. The seats were full, but they put my bag on board. Sweet. So that's good to go. We just have to wait till about 11:30 that night for the bag to show up. So anyways, Bob gets there. He goes and parks and comes in and hangs out with me and we visit. We haven't seen each other for a few months and we're hanging out talking and the fire alarm goes off in the airport. And Bob's like, now you're never going to get your bag, man. They're not going to let anybody get off the plane. The airport's going to burn down. We're thinking, really? What's this? And we're like thinking like, okay, well, like what do we do here? Like, where is outside of the airport, right? Like, because you just, it's all these parking garages and stuff. Like, what is truly outside? Like, get out of the building, right? So that's what I'm thinking about. And we see four firefighters come by and they look really confused. They look really confused. And me and Bob was just kind of making some jokes, like maybe they forgot where they parked their fire truck, you know, or something. But anyways, the fire alarm turned off and we're like, well, I guess they found the fire. I don't know why it was going off. It was just training drill or what they were doing. The firefighters looked good to go, just a little confused. But so anyways, I was like, well, the bag makes it. And luckily, right after that, the bag showed up. The plane landed, my bag shows up, and now we got a 2-hour drive to Bob and Alicia's. And as we're heading home, I'm kind of on this high of this leadership talk since I just got done talking with Coach Cruikshank, and I'm talking to Bob. Bob's in the military, and he's in the Air Force, and he'd been in leadership positions, and I kind of carry this stuff along with him, and it's just amazing the parallels. Good leadership is good leadership, whether you're riding your mule, whether you're leading, you know, in the military, or you're leading as a coach of a football team, or as the president of a college, or as a teacher of a fifth grade class, or whatever it is you do, good leadership principles apply across the board. And but the one that kept ringing the most that Bob said and Coach Cruikshank said is the people you're leading, or in our case, we're talking about our mules and our horses. They need to know you care. They need to know you care. And this kind of stuck with me. So Saturday comes around. And I'll admit I did sleep in till 7 o'clock. So I did not get up at 4:30 on Saturday. We were out till 2, but I got up at 7. So I felt way behind and, hang out at Bob and Alicia's house, go to the grocery store, got some barbecue. It was good. And, helped Bob clean up around the house. He let me rent his vintage backhoe. It was a pretty old machine. And, but it felt good to get out and do a little work on the tractor and just something different than riding. I ride mules all day, every day, just about, you know, and so getting out on the tractor felt good, do something else. And participants started rolling in. Now, we had to rebook this clinic in South Carolina because, my grandmother passed away, about a week and a half ago from this recording. And so the clinic was originally Wednesday through Friday, but my grandma's funeral is Thursday. So it's either rebook or cancel. And we was able to rebook it. And 3 of the 5 participants were able to come. 2 of them couldn't make it, had to reschedule and redo some stuff. So that meant 3 of them that had planned to come were able to come. We had 2 new people. And we had, you know, of course, Alicia Camberg. She was the host of the clinic and the main participant organizing all this stuff, the clinic host. And then we had Nancy Slides, who is our clinic host for Cripple Creek, Virginia. And then Christy Kovner, who is our clinic host for Natural Bridge, Virginia. So we have 3 clinic hosts here. And then we have 2 other people, a man named Howard, who I kept mistakenly calling Harold. I messing up on his name. And he finally let me know it. But and then another new student named Bonnie. So Bonnie and Harold, there you go, Harold. Bonnie and Howard
It's their first time coming to one of my clinics. It's their first time coming to, it's first time for Howard to come to a clinic at all. He, you know, Bonnie had been to other people's clinics, but Howard never been to a clinic, never. I mean, and I asked, okay, you guys watched many videos. I said, we just started watching them. Alicia told us to watch them just a few days ago. So we're starting to watch, they watched just a couple videos. So what about the podcast? They said, well, we have listened to a couple episodes. So they were kind of thrown to the wolves just right away, just thrown right into the fire. They don't know much about me. They don't know about all these, you know, this mealmanship checklist and these principles and all this stuff. They just get thrown right into it. And, you know, I was really impressed. I was so impressed on how quick they picked up on this stuff. They picked up on it so quick. And, you know, it was similar to Florida with the tools, with the saddles and the, you know, the headgear and all that. You know, there's just a lot of mythical information out there. Why you have to use this, why you have to use that. And I tried to simplify that for them. And, you know, mostly just try to lead by example, just do what I do and show them the results of it. Hopefully people see the fruits of your labor. What's challenging about the equine world is there's so many different things going on, and a lot of people get kind of wrapped up in their own little world that people maybe sometimes miss out on noticing what success looks like in others. You know, if you're ever wondering what you should do, find somebody pretty successful. What do they do? What are they using? You know, how do they work things out? That's what I'm looking at all the time. Whenever I get a chance to be around somebody that's better than me, I'm always analyzing, well, what are they doing? You know, what kind of gear they use? What's their principles like? What principles do they apply that are really successful? What's the most consistent principle they use? You know, how do they get this done? How do they get that done? That's the kind of stuff I'm paying attention to. And so I hope that for my students, when you guys come to my clinic, that I can be an example for that, that you have somebody to look to. But yeah, I kind of have to have that mentality, right? Like you have to have that craving to know what success looks like. I love success of any kind. I love hearing about your businesses, about your families, about your church, about your job, about your mules, your donkeys, your horses, about your garden, whatever it is. I am addicted to success. I love it. I want you guys to be successful in everything you do, whatever it is. And there's key parts to success that are so interesting to me, you know, and that's the kind of stuff I pay attention to. And anyway, so, you know, as these folks, you know, hung out and rode in the clinic, I was really leaning on Alicia and Christy and Nancy to be ambassadors for this style of mealmanship. And they did not let me down. It was so impressive how Nancy, Alicia, and Christy just welcomed Howard and Bonnie in and made them feel so comfortable. And, you know, Alicia was a wonderful host. I mean, we had such a great time at her place, and we can't wait to go back. Next year, she's going to do a colt starting there in South Carolina. So if you want to come watch that, that'd be great. And she's going to do another semi-private. But all three of them just welcomed them in and were so kind and generous in sharing knowledge and sharing these principles and talking about what we do. And they were demonstrating real care. They really cared about Bonnie and Howard. They cared that they got along good. They cared that they understood. And that was seen, and I believe that, I would like to believe that Howard and Bonnie felt that care. I hope they did. And that see, this theme just carried on. You know, this theme of caring. And we talked about, you know, working with their mules. Does your mule know that you care about these things? It's not just me shouting orders. When you pick up your rein, are you doing it with care? When you ask them a question, doing it with the care. Does your mule know you care? So after basically 3 days of this semi-private clinic in South Carolina, I was extremely impressed with Alicia and Nancy and Christy. Not only were they amazing examples to the other two that were brand new to the fold, really, they also were making great progress of their own. Each and every one of them, you know, and each and every one had their own little struggles. We kind of joked about the theme of the clinic being lift on your rein, pick up your rein, pick it up and not pull. We worked through that with all of them. Everybody was pulling the rein to their hips and pulling the rein to their belly, pulling it to their chest. And we talked about keeping that rein out ahead of you. Lift the rein, pick up the rein, don't pull the rein, pick it up, pick it up. And that kind of became the theme for them. So that was kind of fun. You know, we talked about self-image quite a lot. You know, you need to be what you want your mule to become. And you want to see yourself as you would like your mule to see you. So if you're calling yourself names, if you're saying, gosh, I'm just a dummy, I'm an idiot. All right. This is not healthy self-image stuff. That's not real. That's not real. I think a lot of people will say things like that to protect themselves. And a lot of people say that kind of stuff around me. And I try to correct them right away. I think they say it around me because they want to protect themselves in case they think that I think that. First of all, I don't think any of you are dumb or an idiot or stupid or any of that. Doesn't work that way for me. It doesn't work that way. You need to be positive about yourself. You need to believe in yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, how do you expect your mule or your horse to believe in you? If you don't have confidence in yourself, how do you expect them to have confidence in you? Whatever you want them to be, however you want them to think, you need to think and be that first. So we talked about that. We talked a bunch about setting it up for the mule to succeed, for the mules, you know, for it to be their idea. We talked about how to really make the right thing easy. And we talked about applying the principle of making the right thing easy and wrong thing difficult and what that looks like, the differences of that. And that's some of the best things about the semi-private clinics is that we get to, every morning we sit around the fire or in their house or whatever, and we get to discuss these principles in more depth. We discuss them in our regular clinics, of course, but I'm talking about principles while you guys are out there trying to move a hip over or do a transition or back them up or whatever. Whereas in the semi-private clinics, we can actually sit there and you can bring your notebook, your pen, and we can really dive deep on what these principles really mean. And that was fun for me. And I hope they appreciate it. This was our first semi-private clinic, you know, on the East Coast, really, you know. So that was pretty fun. But all in all, we made great progress. I was able to ride a mule that I sold a few years back called Cimarron. I got to ride her. She's a pretty cool mule. Also got to ride Alicia's Arabian named Dancer. And kind of show her how the Hackamore works. We were able to kind of progress to the Hackamore with that horse and show Alicia how you pick up on the rein, emphasis on picking it up. In the Hackamore, you cannot get away with pulling. You can get away with all kinds of pulling with a snaffle bit. You really can. It's a very forgiving tool. The Hackamore is not forgiving. You cannot pull it and get any result you want. You got to lift up on that Hackamore So it was fun working through that, learning through that. We had an amazing bit session. Alicia has, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, close to 100 bits of all kinds of snaffles, all kinds of shame. I mean, whatever. She is definitely a collector, okay? Christy brought some bits as well. And so one morning we had a little class on bits, and we talked about the functionality of them, how they worked. And, you know, afterwards I was thinking, man, it would have been good to film this. And so next time I go to South Carolina, I get to hang out with Alicia and all those bits. I mean, she has more bits than I probably ever will. And I was like, hey, you know what? Next time we go, I want to film talking about how all those things work and the progression and what I'm looking at there. And the emphasis was on making bridal mules. That's what they wanted to know about. So we talked about the process of going, you know, from the snaffle to the hackamore to the two-rein to the bridle. And we talked about selecting bridle bits and how they work and how the sweep works and, you know, what these things really look like. How does the function of this bit actually, occur in the mouth, and what are they feeling? So we did that, and that was quite a bit of fun, but, I gotta mention the food. Bob cooked for me the whole time. And I was so grateful to you, Bob. Thank you so much. Great food. And, stayed with Bob and Alicia. They were kind enough to let me have a room. So I enjoyed my time. I was our first ever clinic in South Carolina. First time ever being there. And it was just so good. So fly out on Tuesday night. And by the time I fly home, land in Salt Lake, Sky came up and picked me up, which I felt bad that she had to drive 2 hours up to the airport and 2 hours back. 4 hours of driving to come get me from the airport. But she was willing. And she was really happy to see me. And I was happy to see her too. Girls stayed at grandma's house, so they didn't have to drive so much. And anyways, by the time we got home, it was pretty darn late. And spent the next day preparing for my grandma's funeral, really. And, normally I wouldn't share, these personal things on here, a lot of you knew Grandma Sheila. I've talked about her here on this podcast. Grandma Sheila was on every Mule Tip Tuesday from 2016 up until last week when she passed away. Every single Mule Tip Tuesday, she didn't miss a single one. She set her alarm by it. She'd watch it every week. And she could answer all kinds of mule questions. She really could. It was great. We'd play around and visit, and she'd say, "Well, how's that mule doing? What's going on?" And Grandma didn't ride mules, and but she was so supportive. And at her funeral yesterday, it wasn't a funeral; it was a celebration of life. I was asked to kind of preside at the celebration of life, and which was just really hard. In the family, I don't consider myself. It's funny when you're with your family, with the elders of your family, with your parents and your aunts and uncles and grandparents and, whoever's still alive, in my family, I still consider myself a kid. I'm not one of the adults yet. And I'm sure some of you can, what I'm saying? You can relate that you don't feel like the adult yet, And I was kind of asked to step up and be the adult here and preside. And at first, I kind of felt, like, oh, geez, that's not my place. Her sons, they're all older, like my dad, and they should say it and do all that stuff. But said, no, I can do this because I had so many great lessons from Grandma. I mean, she taught me so much. And there's a bunch of lessons here that I thought would be fun to share with you guys. All these apply to mules and horses and kids and life and business and everything. It's just life. There was a common theme at Grandma's celebration of life. Everybody thought they were her favorite. I got up and the first things I said was, "All right, you guys, I just got to come clean with you. Me and Grandma Sheila, we've been keeping a secret for almost 35 years. And I was kind of saying it serious, like, and I said, for the past almost 35 years, I've been the favorite." And everybody laughed, of course. And that kind of ran through the whole thing. Somebody else would come up and they say, "Well, actually, I'm the favorite. Grandma told me so," right? Or Aunt Sheila or Mom or who, they are all, everybody got up and shared. And Grandma made everybody feel like they were her favorite. Do you make your mule feel like they are your favorite? That got me thinking. I hope my mules feel that. I hope my, and I know this is not reality, you guys. This is not science. This is just, a fun comment, but I would like to think that they're out there arguing, no, I'm the favorite. No, I'm Ty's favorite. No, he likes me more. No, he likes me more. Wouldn't that be fun? But you get the point. It'd be great to leave that feeling with them. You know, whenever I was with Grandma, and in these later years, you know, one of my regrets, I guess it's not a regret, it's just reality. Due to me traveling all over, being with you guys, you know, doing clinics, I haven't been able to see her as much. I mean, we're gone 8 or 9 months a year, so I don't get to see her. But the times that I did get to spend with her, you know, together in the same room, it was quality time. And it was pure. And she would listen and she would talk with me. And it was so, there was so much quality in that time spent. You know, it was as if we didn't miss a beat. I might not have seen her for 3 months or 4 months sometimes even. And we didn't miss a beat. We just pick up right where we left off. And she would ask me about you guys. She knew a lot of you. Not directly, you know, she didn't meet any of you, but she would see you on social media. So she would read all my comments. If you've ever left a comment on social media, Grandma read it. And so a lot of you guys came up quite a bit. She'd ask, well, how's she doing? You know, how's Lisa Taka down in Arizona? How's Megan Mensing? How's Christy out there in Virginia? You know, how's your friend Christine up there in Pennsylvania? You know, how's Jesse up in Montana? You know, she knew a lot of you. She really did. And she cared about you. It was genuine. When you work with your mule, do you care? You see how this theme has lasted the last 2 weeks? It's just incredible to me. You know, talking to Coach Cruikshank on the plane from Atlanta to Charlotte, talking to Bob Camberg, military leader, you know, while in South Carolina, coming home and going to Grandma's celebration of life and realizing how much she cared and how much that is the most important thing is, do they know you care? And I know she cared. And anyways, it was just a great experience. You know, Grandma had left a letter. She said that she didn't want any sadness at her funeral. That's a lot to ask. And Grandma always acknowledged how tough I was. And she'd say, man, you're tough. Grandma had seen me injure so many things. She's been there, so many broken bones, so many busted ribs and bones and legs and arms and fingers and all the things I busted. Grandma was there. And she didn't want to coddle me. She would just say, man, it's a good thing you're tough. It's a good thing you're tough. She knew what I chose to do. She knew when I rodeoed and as I'm training colts and as I'm working mules and horses, she knew the choice that I made in my life and that injuries are going to come along with it. It's just part of the game when you're working with an animal so big. So she didn't say, oh, boo-hoo, poor you. She'd say, it's a good thing you're tough. You know, I just love Grandma so much. And she was tough too. She suffered from a terrible lung disease. The past 7 years, the doctor had given her 2 to 5 years, and she lived 7 more. So she beat it. And all this time, whenever I talked to her, I'd, how you doing, Grandma? Oh, I'm good, but how's that clinic out there? She would change the subject. She did not like to talk about her illness. And she never once complained to me about her illness. She's tough, and I appreciate that lesson so much, to be tough. You know, something else my grandma taught me ever since I was a little kid. When I was a little kid, she'd come pick me up, and we'd go to the store, we'd go whatever. And Grandma was never scared to talk to a stranger. And it'd be easy to stand in line talking to some random person for hours sometimes. And I'd get so annoyed as a kid. Grandma, come on. But you know what? I realize now, all those times spent with grandma talking to strangers taught me how to talk to you guys. Because she just wasn't shy. And that was a great example. That's why I can talk to Coach Cruikshank on an airplane, or I can visit with you at a clinic. She taught us not to be shy. Talk to a stranger. Let them know you cared. It was pretty cool. You know, I have so many things I could say about grandma. You know, the last thing I want to say is grandma expected us to succeed. Not just me, but all of her grandkids and her kids. She expected us to succeed. She knew we was going to win. I remember back in 2008, I called Grandma and Grandpa. I said, hey, I want to talk to you too. See, Grandma and Grandpa, they've been coming to my rodeos, you know, since I was started in high school. They came to a ton of rodeos. When I made it to the College National Finals rodeo, the CNFR, which was probably the biggest accomplishment that I achieved. I made it twice. I made it in 08 and I made it in 2010. That was probably the biggest accomplishment I made in my bronc riding career. But they came to them. They came and watched. Very, very important time in my life. And they were there to support me. Those two and Sky, of course. So Grandma and Sky, they have been probably my two biggest cheerleaders, you know, my whole life. And they both expect me to win. They both expect everybody to succeed. I remember calling them 2008, calling Grandma in 2008, saying, Grandma, I want to get my PRCA card. What do you think? Think I can do it? And she said, well, why not? Of course you can. You're as good as them. And she started naming guys and, you know, you can do that. Of course you can. She just expected success. Why not? She'd say. And that memory was flown through my mind during the celebration of life. And I was thinking the same thing about you guys. When you come to me and, hey, Ty, can I get along with this mule? Ty, can I have the success like you have had? Can I get this done like you do? Well, why not? Of course you can. Do it. Work hard. Put in the effort. Keep your chin up. Be positive. Be tough. Be fair. You can do it. Why not? And that's how Grandma was. I loved it. I just loved it so much. When I started doing clinics, my first clinic was in 2012. And I started building up, going from there and getting requests and more requests. And so 2012 and 13 and 14, pretty much everything was just local in Utah. 2015, I got invited to my first clinic out of state, which was in Gunnison, Colorado, which we're coming up on 10 year anniversary this year, which is pretty fun. But Grandma, what do you think about this? You think I ought to, what do you think? Should I cut back on training mules for the public? At that time, I was taking like 20 a month for the public. I mean, I was full-time working mules for the public. You know, we were riding, I mean, a couple hundred a year for the public. What do you think, Grandma? Think I should go do clinics? Well, why not? Of course you can. Do you have stuff you want to share? There's people that could use your help. Why not? She was all for it. So a lot of you guys can thank Grandma for encouraging me to get to this point. She taught me so much. But again, the very best lesson that I ever got from Grandma was that when you were talking to her, when you were around her, you felt like you were her favorite and you knew that she cared. So I encourage you to work with your mules the way Grandma treated everybody. When you go work with your mules, your horses, make sure they know that you care. Make sure that they think that they're your favorite. You guys, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this episode. I appreciate you. I'd love to hear your feedback. You can leave a review on Apple. Leave 5 stars if you think I'm worth it. And leave a little comment on there. I'd love to hear from you. If you can't leave a comment, you can always send me an email. My email is ty@tsmules.com. I'd love to hear from you guys. But I appreciate you so much. Thanks for listening. You guys, God bless you. And we'll see you down the road.